Welcome to the Gritty Hour. Time to get down to the nitty gritty.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Gritty Hour. I'm here with Professor Bob Pucci, who's been on a couple of times before. He's a retired professor of media, and he taught media and communications in the New York State area. How you doing, Mr. Professor, Mr. Pucci?
I'm doing well. I'm celebrating my first year anniversary, and Saturday is the first commencement I will not be going to in, I don't know, maybe 30 or 40 years.
Wow. Are you lamenting it or glorifying it?
Well, I saw an email today that they're having it inside the gym, and that usually is torture because the temperature in there is about 130 degrees, you know. So I will be feeling sorry for my fellow colleagues, former colleagues.
It's probably good for them. So as we're recording this on the 18th of May. Can't believe it's the 18th of May already, but there is a prediction of rain for Saturday in the Hudson Valley.
Yeah, and that's why they moved it indoors.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
It was always a terrible thing when they did.
Do you ever think the weathermen would wield so much power?
Well, you know.
Yeah. But anyway, we're doing a top 10 favorite movies of all time lists. I did a couple with George Bauer in the past, top 10 albums of all time. And top 10 concerts of all time. And I'll use the same spiel I gave for those two, which is this is all subjective, number one. And number two, I think Professor Pucci will agree with me. If we did this tomorrow instead of today, there might be half the list might be completely different.
Right. I mean, I can probably, for every number, I can give you two or three alternates.
Yes, and maybe at the end of this, we'll touch quickly on a couple that didn't make the top 10 list. So let's start with your 10. I know what your 10 is already, and I'm going to cue up some visuals as we discuss these things. And your number 10 is
Pan's Labyrinth, Guillermo del Toro.
Uh-huh.
And you know, it's a a fairly recent film, and a lot of times I always like wait a certain number of years after seeing a film to decide if it's the kind of film that I would show, for example, in my film class. But this film has a lot of the characteristics that make it the kind of film that I could watch over and over again. Mm-hmm. And that's one of my personal criterion for a good movie, and a movie that would make my list would be one that if someone said, oh, I'm going to put on, you know, whatever movie, I'd go, yeah, that sounds good. I'll watch it. I think what I like about this film, aside from its sort of surrealistic aspects and it's sort of like toying with the idea of what is real, there's like a fairy tale environment, and then there's a realistic environment. The realistic environment during the Spanish, past the Spanish Civil War, is just brutal. The villain of the piece is perhaps one of the worst people you'd ever want to meet in the cinema. And this young girl, Ophelia, sort of gets lost in her fairy tale books. But as it develops, it seems that maybe the fairy tales are real, and the reality is the ugly thing that has to be suppressed.
Hmm. And that came out what year?
I'm trying to see if you go down the page. It's 2006.
Okay, and the plot takes place in 1944.
1944, and actually there's a moment in there where the resistance fighters learn of D-Day.
Ah.
And they at least realize that the fascism of Germany and Italy are going to be defeated, even if Spain is going to be under the yoke of Franco for quite a number of years.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that the plot takes place in 1944, because I've always been curious why Spain never joined the Axis powers in World War II, you know?
I think that they probably just didn't have the horses, and they were still sort of battling this resistance of you know, what was kind of like the Republicans of people believed in the Republic. Uh-huh. And, you know, they were too busy. You know, after all, the Picasso's most famous painting, Guernica, is about the Germans bombing a Spanish city on behalf of Franco.
Mm-hmm. You know, I had downloaded a photo for this movie, and maybe you can, I don't want to dwell too long on one movie, but maybe you can just explain a little bit of the plot, because it looks like there's an alien sitting next to a girl. I don't know. The photo
That's one of the monsters in the fantasy, or it could be the fawn. I don't know.
I don't know if you can see that photo.
Yeah, that's the monster. Now, this is the monster in the sort of the fairy tale world. She is actually a princess who has escaped to the earth and trying to get back to her people. Who live below the earth. And she's given several tasks. And in this particular scene, she is given the task of taking something. She's not supposed to eat anything. If she eats something, the monster comes to life and chases her. Now, it's interesting that as you know, this is the monster. The real monster and the monster in the real world is also having a dinner at this time. Mm-hmm. So there's a parallel between this, you know, this sort of fairy tale or fictional theoretic monster and the real monster, or the monster in 1944 Franco's Spain.
I've never seen the movie, but haven't hearing you describe it, now I want to see the movie, you know.
Well, not only that, I mean, it really gets to you, because, you know, in the end, you're kind of like saying, well, what would you rather believe? Would you rather believe the fairy tale or the reality that is presented in the film?
Right.
And you know, it's kind of like, I guess it's kind of test of whether you're a pessimist or an optimist.
Mm. Very good. I'll check it out. Well, my number 10, if I can, is came out right after the end of World War II, called The Best Years of Our Lives. And I don't know if you can see that. What I like most about this movie, first of all, it was really my first, I saw it first as an adult. And it was really my first exposure to Frederick March. I didn't realize what a great actor he was, you know. And Dana Andrews, as you can see, the cast here. It's really a story about returning GIs and the reincorporation, if you will, into American society after they get released from military service after World War II. And, you know, there's one fella who had lost his arms. And I guess it touches on post-traumatic stress disorder before that term was even in vogue. And it makes it makes it indispensable if you want to learn about that era, in my view.
Well, it is a great film. Yeah. You know, the only thing that kept me from showing it in my film class is that it's 3 hours long.
Yeah, it's an investment of time, but it's well worth it if you want to learn more about it. I think it won the Academy Award, if I'm not mistaken.
1-7.
Yeah. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I could be. I think it beat out my number one pick for tonight's episode of The Gritty Hour for Best Picture.
Oh, I do believe that it was also a 1946 release.
Yeah. So, but I highly recommend it to anybody, again, that wants to learn about the trials and tribulations of getting released from the military service and working your way back into the fabric of American society. And with that, we'll go to your number nine, which I believe is Sullivan's Travels.
Sullivan's Travels. Now, all right. You know, this, a lot of this is, it's a great movie on a number of areas in a number of ways, but it's also been a great influencer in terms of, you know, things that happen in this movie and presented in this movie, you know, are taken up by various directors, including especially the Coen brothers, who in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? You know, kind of like riff on various things that are present in this movie. It takes place during the Depression. A very successful movie director, seen on the left there, Joel McRae, decides that after doing a series of musicals and light comedies, he wants to do something serious. Mm. So he presents his producers with a book called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou?
Ah.
And, you know, it's a very sort of serious book about the Depression. Okay, Sullivan's Travels. You know, it's a movie by Preston Sturges, who went from Broadway and became a very successful screenwriter director. And in fact, his first film he actually directed. You know, he offered Paramount, the movie studio, that he would do it for a dollar because they kept screwing up his screenplays.
Wow.
And so as a director, Sullivan's Travels, perhaps one of a couple of masterpieces that he made in a very short period of time. And it's about a director who's very successful in doing comedies and musicals. One of them is called Ants in Your Plants, and you know, wants to do a serious movie.
Uh-huh.
And he has a novel that he wants to adapt called Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, which the Coen brothers riff on in their film. And the producers reluctantly agree to let him go. But he can't go on his sojourn as a hobo alone. So they send a whole crew with him that he keeps trying to lose. And one of the running jokes of the film is that he seems to always wind up back in Los Angeles. But eventually he does have an adventure. He is beaten by a hobo. He takes his shoes and they think he's dead. And he winds up on a train as a hobo, and he attacks a yard person, and he gets sent to a work camp. And there's a Deus Ex Machina ending where he proclaims that he's killed himself because his murder has never been solved. And then, of course, they discover his identity, and he goes back to Hollywood, and he's successful. And they say, do you still want to make the movie? And he says, yes. And it does a lot of very interesting things. You know, you're seeing, you know, the real conditions of the Depression.
Uh-huh.
You see African Americans in not a stereotypical light. There's an incredible scene where the prisoners are taken to an African American church where they're going to show a Mickey Mouse comedy. Mm-hmm. And the minister sings, you know, Go Down Moses. And he says, now, be kind to our guests. Do not look down upon them. And, you know, it's very sort of ironic. And also there's a scene where black and white prisoners are passing along a cup of water. And this must have driven people in the South absolutely nuts. You know, he was really pushing the envelope in this film in presenting a view of America, you know, and beautifully sort of coded in comedy, you know, slapstick type comedy, and also having beautiful eye candy, you know, in The Girl. And The Girl is played by
Veronica Lake.
Monica Lake.
Yeah.
And, you know, the interesting thing is that at one point there's a character who says, "What's she doing in the picture?" and Sullivan, the director, you know, the character says, "There's always a girl in the picture." You know, and so it is also making fun of, you know, sort of like the conventions of movies. Mm-hmm. You know, there's got to be a love interest.
Right.
You know, and there's got to be, you know, this this feeling that, you know, there is a kind of a sexual undercurrent that is, of course, greatly limited by the production code.
Yeah,
but it is really a very rich, wonderful film. Came out the same year as Citizen Kane.
Wow!
And as much as I do like Citizen Kane, I would argue that this is equally good.
Wow, interesting. All right, so if you don't mind, I'll give you my number nine. Number nine, Professor Pucci, is called Tales of Manhattan. I mentioned this a couple of times to you in the past. I don't know if you ever had a chance to see this movie.
Never had a chance.
Yeah. It's basically a movie. It's a bunch of different vignettes, but it all centers around one coat. It's one jacket. And there's a lot of, at the time, famous actors that were in the movie. And they all had their own separate vignettes. If you could look at, you could probably see the cast of characters here. Charles mm-hmm. Boyer, Rita Hayworth, Ginger Rogers, Henry Fonda, Charles Laughton, Edward G. Robinson, Ethel Ward, Paul Robeson, and W.C. Fields. So they were all in their own separate vignettes, but it all centers around this one particular coat. As an example, Charles Laughton was an aspiring conductor. He wrote music in his apartment, in his little rundown apartment in Manhattan. And whatever happened, he gets hooked up with this famous conductor who gives him who loves his music and gives him a shot at conducting the orchestra. And during his jacket rips, all right? It tears. And everybody in the audience starts laughing at him. And, you know, in what you would expect Charles Laughton kind of reaction to it would be, you know. And someone gives him a jacket. And this jacket, and then he performs wonderfully. And the crowd all loves him, okay? He then donates the jacket to this. He's walking after the show. He's in a celebratory mood with his wife and whoever. And they're walking down the street in Manhattan, and he sees a Salvation Army type table there for donations. And he donates this jacket. And the jacket gets sent down to the Bowery and makes its way to the next vignette, which is Edward G. Robinson. He's a drunk. He's used to be successful, but alcohol has driven him into the Bowery, and he's living on Skid Row. And he gets this invitation to go to his college reunion, and all the other fellas were all successful, and he doesn't want to go. And the people that are running the place where he's staying in the Bowery push him to go, and they get this jacket, and they give him this jacket, and he uses the jacket and blah, blah, blah. And it keeps going through various different vignettes with this one particular jacket. Right. And it's a very interesting movie just for that. Even W.C. Fields wears the jacket for a while. And Paul Robeson, again, you see African-Americans, in a different light than you would normally do, the way you mentioned in Sullivan's Travels. Yeah. I highly recommend it anyway. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Sounds great.
And we'll go right. I feel like you should watch this movie, Bob.
I will.
Yeah. So your next one is a silent picture. One of the 1920 specials.
Right.
The general.
Some people consider it Buster Buster Keaton's masterpiece. And certainly, you know, for me, there are a couple of things that interest it. It's set in the Civil War. You know, he's the hero and he's on the Confederate side. He's a locomotive engineer. And because he has that position, they won't take him into the army. His love interest construes this as cowardice, as does her family, and he's ostracized. But as it turns out, Union agents come to steal his train, and he is determined to get the train back. And the film has this kind of sort of circular structure where, you know, he chases the train, he gets the train, and then they chase him back, you know, to his lines. And he winds up defeating the army, capturing a Union general, and they make him a lieutenant
in at the end in of the film. In the Confederate Army.
Yes, in the Confederate Army. Yeah. And, of course, it was directed by Clyde Bruckman, but only some degree in name. It's Buster Keaton all the way. Bruckman was kind of like the guy making sure the camera worked kind of thing. But, you know, he was it was based on a real story. And some of the stunts in it are just incredible. Of course, you know, there's a meme on the internet where they show various actors and their stuntmen. So they'll show Hugh Jackman and his stuntmen and The Rock and his stuntmen. And the last picture is Buster Keaton and his stuntman, Buster Keaton. You know, so
so he's doing all his own stunts.
Right. And in this film, you know, he does a couple of sort of very acrobatic things and a couple of very funny things. Of course, his most famous stunt was standing and having a building fall on him, where he's standing where the only window is. And, you know, it's just part of this, you know, this wonderful career that he had in the silent era. You know, when talkies came in, he unfortunately hitched his wagon to MGM. They took over his films. He became an alcoholic. You know, he kind of lost everything. He wound up writing gags for movies like the Marx Brothers. And fortunately, he crawled out of that, had an incredible career revival in the 50s and 60s before he died. But he is perhaps one of the greatest stars of the silent era.
All right. So my number eight, Professor, is the first of two Frank Capra movies, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. This is a tale of power corrupting. And what I like about this particular choice is that it shows the more things change, the more things stay the same. It's about this young guy played by Jimmy Stewart, who was one of Capra's favorite actors, getting elected to Congress and seeing how the real world works in Congress, and the power corrupting the innocent, if you will, or the naive, if you will. And the acting is just stupendous, and the storyline is stupendous, and you know, it's almost like a comfort movie when you see what's going on in the world today. It gives you a reminder that the more things change, as I say, the more things stay the same. So,
and it's got Claude Rains.
It does. Yes, he was the corrupting influence.
Right.
He was the guy who was at the time the character played by Jimmy Stewart. That he was his idol, right? And you know, the Jimmy Stewart's character looked up to him, and when he got to Congress, he saw the corruption that can go on behind the scenes in the halls of Congress. And you know, it's you know, you look at the real world today, and you, and that makes this movie ever poignant, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
So on the waterfront, right, Professor Pucci?
Yes, on the waterfront. Now, you know, it just so happens that almost every film on my list I show in my film class. And this film is one that, you know, the class tends to really like, even though it's got a couple of bad things going for it. You know, it was made in the 50s. It's in black and white. And when I tell the students that Marlon Brando is the same Marlon Brando who played The Godfather, they're astonished. You know, because they don't know it, but it's a great film because, again, the performances are just flawless. Everyone in the cast just does such an incredible job. Mm-hmm. It's a great story. You know, it's one where, you know, Terry Molloy is considered a bum. And I always tell my students, you know, how you know he's a bum? Even the bum says he's a bum in the movie.
Well, you had mentioned, I should have said before we even got to this one that Professor Pucci was kind enough to join us on an episode where we discussed what makes a great movie great. And this was prominent in that particular episode, which I'll link to at the end of this video.
So, you know, the thing is that he also, you know, he's seeking redemption, you know, and it's, even though it's a very sort of realistic movie and it's kind of patterned after the Italian neorealism of the time, you know, it's got an incredible amount of symbolism and parallelism going on. And of course, he needs to be redeemed. He needs to be redeemed in the legal sense and testify. He needs to be redeemed in the ethical sense and own up to his crime or his responsibilities. And finally, he's got to be redeemed on the waterfront. And so, and that's why, you know, there's this climactic battle between him and Johnny Friendly. And it's really just got just about everything that you could want in a film in terms of, you know, subject matter and acting and plot. And, you know, and it was also a kind of a debut of all of the actors were sort of trained or brought up through the Actors Studio. And they sort of introduced this new note of realism in the acting.
Was this all that they were they relatively unknown? Because all of these actors I've heard of, Rod Steiger, Lee J. Cobb, were they still
right
up and coming at the time?
They were pretty much unknown at the time. Mm-hmm. It was Eva Marie Saint's debut. I don't think that Carl Malden had made very many movies before this, or even Rod Steiger. So, you know, this was really something that, you know, put. Boxer actually had a part in this film, but he wound up on the cutting room floor.
Oh, really? Interesting. Lee J. Cobb, wasn't he in 12 yeah. Angry Men with Henry Fonda?
Oh, yes. He was the angriest man.
Yeah.
Yeah. He did angry very well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, very good. That's a good movie. I enjoyed that movie myself. So, okay, Professor. So my number seven is a 1970 movie called Waterloo, starring Rod Steiger, who was also in On the Waterfront that we just discussed. And what I like about this movie, obviously it's about Napoleon and the Battle of Waterloo, essentially. But what I like most about this movie is the kitchen sink aspect of it. Like they must have had 50,000 reenactors playing the English and the French armies. And they just threw everything at that they could at this movie, and it just makes it so grandiose. It's a visual masterpiece, you know, and that's why I like it. I have one photo I wanted to share with you, just to give you an indication of what the scenes look like in this movie. There's no CGI back then. This is all people, you know, cavalry and soldiers. This is the British Army facing off against the French Army, And it does give you, it is a learning tool to learn about the Battle of Waterloo. It's relatively factually correct. And it gives you a little insight into the mindset of both General Wellington and Napoleon. You know, their thoughts during the battle. They, you know, I don't know how much liberties they took with that, but it was very insightful in that regard. So that's I highly recommend this movie just for its cinematography. I don't know if you've ever seen it.
No, but I have to tell you a little anecdote that's related to this film.
Okay.
At about for many years, and in fact, it was during this period that Stanley Kubrick was contemplating a Napoleon movie, one that was never made. Uh-huh. And right now they're trying to recreate it as he would have done it. And this movie was one of the reasons why his Napoleon was not made.
He just because, thought it was done well enough, this one? Is that the reason behind
no,
it?
No, it was just like it didn't go over very well at the box office.
Yeah, yeah.
So convincing producers, you know, to invest millions of dollars.
Yeah.
And Kubrick was always very meticulous in his research. Mm-hmm. He had historians coming in. He interviewed them. He had models of battles laid out, you know, like the way you'd lay out a train set.
Yeah.
And
the toy soldiers.
But it never got done.
Wow. Ironically, this was filmed in Ukraine. Not ironically, but it was filmed in the Ukraine. But just for the grandiose nature of it, it's well worth a watch. So,
right, and I'm sure they used a lot of Soviet soldiers as the extras.
Absolutely,
that you know, and actually related to that, Buster Keaton used the National Guard. You know, they put on the Union uniforms, then they put on the Confederate Union forms, and he had also thousands of extras.
Oh, well, they had to, I might have exaggerated, but there had to have been at least 10,000 extras in this movie. It's just incredible. So let's move on to your number six.
Okay. So, you know, as I said, you know, a lot of times I have to wait a number of years before I think about a film as being sort of worthy to add to my class, because I think one of the things about a very good movie is that it is not something of its time, but it's something for all time.
Right.
So a movie like, for example, The General, which is now 90, almost 100 years old.
Yep. 1924,
still works.
Yeah.
Still works.
1926, sorry.
But, you know, in Wes Anderson is a director of, you know, incredible visual talent. And in Grand Budapest Hotel, you know, he basically creates a fictional world that was destroyed by the world wars. And he does it in a very sort of clever way with different framings and different times. It is a kind of funny film. It's very entertaining. You see actors in makeup that you almost can't recognize, like William Dafoe and Tilda Swinton. And it has an incredible performance by Ralph Fiennes, or Ralph Fiennes. Mm-hmm. If you think about his range, you know, he plays the brutal Nazi in Schindler's List. Mm-hmm. And in this film, he plays this very sort of sophisticated, but at the same time, a little coarse concierge at this fictional Grand Budapest Hotel.
I remember we brought this up when we were talking about what makes a great movie great. Again, I'll link to that. I think one of the things we brought up was the art of hiring, like you had brought up the point, you have to hire a star to get the actors you want for the movie in order to get the movie financed. And this is a little over the top. I mean, every single one of them is an A-list actor, right?
Right, right. Well, you know, it's Wes Anderson is able to, you know, recruit people. I mean, Bill Murray makes an appearance in this film, for example.
Harvey
and it's
Keitel.
Almost like you want Harvey Keitel, who is, again, you know, kind of almost unrecognizable.
Yeah.
You know, they enjoy working. I would think that, you know, when an actor signs onto a Wes Anderson film, it's sort of like, I'm going on vacation. You know, I'm going to be able to do things and, you know, be in something that's going to be a lot of fun. Yeah, that's one of the things. And in my film class, I use this as the example of mise-en-scène. And that's everything visual that you see in a film, including the acting and their gestures and the blocking of the actors and just incredible, you know, sort of visual comedy combined with a very sort of interesting plot, a little bittersweet, you know, but overall, a very, as this says, a stylish delight.
A stylish delight, yes. But do you think you had mentioned in the beginning of this description of this movie, you know, you had mentioned the general, like some movies stand the test of time, I guess you were, in essence, what you were saying. And do you think any of these actors that got on board for this movie realized that this might be one of those types of movies that would stand the test of time?
I don't know. You know, I think that a lot of times actors have been in films and they didn't really think that much of the movie when it was made. Mm-hmm. And, you know, or they thought it was going to be a flop. Mm-hmm. And then it winds up being an award winner. And then it winds up being on, you know, best 100 films list and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And other, you know, other entities pick it up, like, for example, professors who teach film. And they extend the life of the film and also the film's importance or its prominence.
Right. It's something I haven't watched yet, I'm going to admit to.
Okay, but put it on your list.
You certainly will
enjoy it.
I definitely do have it. I definitely do have it on my go-to list. All right. So I'll, all right, Bob, my number six is The Last Waltz, which is a movie about the last go around for the band made famous, mm-hmm, by being Bob Dylan's band and all of their friends who came for a Thanksgiving Day concert where they ate dinner and had a repertoire of American folk music come out. And it's just a piece de resistance for concert movies, in my view. Mm-hmm. It was actually directed by Martin Scorsese. How well known was he when? Did you ever see this movie?
Yes, I don't know if I've seen all of it, but I have seen at least part of it.
How well known was Martin Scorsese when this came out? 76.
In 76, he had just. He was just sort of working and completing Taxi Driver, which was probably the film that made him prominent.
Famous. Mm-hmm.
You know, before that, you know, he had done Mean Streets, which was a very sort of low budget, you know, almost kind of like postgraduate film, and a couple of other, you know, very minor things.
Yeah.
You know, his kind of cinematic eye, if you will, was one way in which, you know, he sort of transformed the concert documentary,
yeah,
with The Last Waltz. See, a lot of times when concerts were filmed, I always say that they were filmed almost with a television head, you know, mm-hmm. a sort of shoulder shot, go to the close-up, three cameras, switch off, you know, pretty much almost like to a script.
Right.
Like when we, you know, like something like The Tonight Show, three cameras, each camera's got two movements. You know, the director says one, two, or three, position A or position B.
Yes.
And
close up on Ringo.
Right, right. And that's, you know, that was kind of like, you know, the way it went.
Yeah.
And of course, this actually opened up the idea that, you know, you could be creative in a documentary and you could show different things and different angles that were not part of the, you know, sort of like the Ed Sullivan presentation of a band.
Well, it was kind of a risk for Martin Scorsese to take this on. But I was curious if you knew as a, you know, given your expertise, if he did any innovative things for this particular concert in terms of filming it that maybe other, as you were just talking about, TV heads were doing previous concerts prior to that.
Well, I think in when you look at it, you know, as a filmmaker, you know, you're interested, like an audience, I think, is in the things that you don't normally see.
Hmm.
You know, like backstage, like one of the greatest scenes in a Martin Scorsese film is in Goodfellas, where Henry Hill takes his girlfriend, you know, to the nightclub, and they go in the secret entrance, and they it's a 3-minute, you know, no cut scene, and they go through the kitchen, and they see all this sort of backstage things, and then suddenly they're on the club floor, and a table magically appears, and a lamp comes down, and you know, and they're seated, and I think people are always fascinated by that the concept of seeing something that they can't see from the audience.
Yeah. Well, what I liked about this particular movie, just I'll read some of these names, Ronnie, from Wikipedia: Ronnie Hawkins, Bob Dylan, Paul Butterfield, Bobby Charles, Eric Clapton, Neil Diamond, Emmylou Harris, Dr. John, Joni Mitchell, Van Morrison, Ringo Starr makes a cameo at the end, and Muddy Waters, which was phenomenal, Ronnie Wood, and Neil Young. And just seeing them perform, most of those names I just read were relatively in their prime, give or take. And as an example, Van Morrison, I thought, stole the show with his performance. And it's just a phenomenal slice of American music for its time. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And especially the finale, which is where this photo comes from. Just seeing all these icons of music up there on the stage at the same time. You know, when you're a kid, I forget what year this came out, but I was a kid when it came out. It was just seeing them all on the stage at the same time was phenomenal, you know. And that's my story. I'm sticking with it, Bob. All right, you're number five, Sir Pucci.
Okay. Well, you know, I had to put a Hitchcock on there, and everybody would say, oh, well, you know, Vertigo is his masterpiece. But I think he made a lot of great films, and I think one of the things that makes Hitchcock a great director was that he was able to really sort of play the audience,
mm-hmm.
you know, and sort of take you on a roller coaster ride, mm-hmm. You know, and I think of North by Northwest as just one of the most fun of his romps, you know, and also it's been seen as kind of like the model for the James Bond movies. And actually, Cary Grant was asked if he wanted to be James Bond, maybe based on this movie.
Really?
Yeah. And he thought he was too old for the part. But You know, the interesting thing about this film was that here we have Eva Marie Saint again. She plays a very seductive double agent. We have a couple of great Hitchcock themes, the mistaken identity, the wrongly accused, as Cary Grant's character is pursued not only by enemy agents, but also the police. and it's also a great sort of comic film in a way. There's some great comic interludes in it. Martin Landau playing trying to play very sort of subtly a gay character at one point is asked by James Mason, one of my favorite actors, you know, why he believes that Eva Marie Saint is not who she pretends to be. And he says, "Call it my women's intuition." And I think it was just a very sort of sly things that go on in the film. And one of the great things, and we're both involved in antiques and collectibles, is the scene in the auction house where Roger Thornhill tries desperately and succeeds in getting arrested. So there are a number of great set pieces here, and who can not enjoy a final chase scene, on Mount Rushmore? Mm. I mean, it's just a great, and they built a model of Mount Rushmore in the studio so they could film that last scene.
Wow. Interesting.
And if you ever see any of the backstage sort of pictures of it, it's quite a set.
Yeah. Well, it's the iconic being chased by the plane scene that everybody remembers from that movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And of course, I always said, in a way, it's science fiction, because after going through that ordeal and being, dusted and falling down in the cornfield, he then goes to the hotel and he asks that his suit be sponged and pressed. And then it comes out looking great. I mean, it's like, it's incredible.
Well, you can do that if you're Cary Grant, Bob.
I don't know. Cary Grant. It's like, you know, where a movie is set in New York City and they park right in front of the building they're going into. Amazing.
Yes, it's kind of like, I don't want to get into the Dutch and Duchess, whatever. All right, very good. I enjoyed that movie myself. All right, Bob, my number five is Going My Way. And it's basically a movie, if you're Irish Catholic like I am, it's hard to not relate to this movie. It's basically, I'm not sure if this came out before or after The Bells of St. Mary's, but it's essentially the same character that Bing Crosby plays, Father O'Malley. And he plays a young priest that goes into a parish that has an old priest as the pastor. And it's sort of not profitable. And he goes in there to change things around. And it's an old tale told very well. And the acting is great in it. And if you're a fan of Barry Fitzgerald, you have to pick either The Quiet Man or Going My Way. And I like Going My Way, because Barry Fitzgerald was phenomenal in this movie.
I believe he was nominated for an Academy Award for this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, the nomination was well deserved because he was phenomenal in the movie. So I highly recommend it. It's sort of Christmassy, but not really. You can watch it any time of the year. That's it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Of them as being extremely sort of creative in terms of how they present a narrative, and their dialogue is usually very entertaining and witty. And in this film, we also have another proclivity that they have, which is to quote other movies. And I think I'm up to like 12 or 14 different movies that are quoted lovingly in this film, from Blazing Saddles to Sullivan's Travels to Night of the Hunter, and of course any other other films, The Grapes of Wrath, and they're all sort of very sort of subtly sort of evoked in this film. And also, this film gave rise to a best-selling album of bluegrass music.
Man of Constant Sorrow.
Man of Constant Sorrow. In fact, you know, if you want to, you know, infuriate a jazz band, ask them to play When the Saints Come Marching In. If you want to infuriate a bluegrass band, ask them to play Man of Constant Sorrow. All right. But it also kind of like touches on kind of like the politics and the scene in 1930s Mississippi. It sort of makes sort of riffs on mass media. At one point, Charles Durning is asked if he wants to press the flesh as the governor. And he says, no, I'm, and he points to the radio, you know, tower that he's about to go into and make a broadcast. I'm mass communicating, you know, so it has, and of course it's based on, Homer's Odyssey, or riffs on Homer's Odyssey. And eventually the, Ulysses McGill, makes it back home, you know, to his wife. But not without all kinds of interesting mishaps along the way, as well as encounters with the Cyclops, played by John Goodman, and the KKK. So it's you know, it's the kind of film that you know, you can always watch for its humor, for its music, and for the dialogue.
Yeah,
it's just great.
Well, you mentioned that it gives a nod to a bunch of different movies. It's only right that they give a nod to Sullivan's Travels, because that's where they got the name of the movie from, right?
Yep.
My number three. Is it number three? No, I'm sorry. My number four is the movie Gettysburg, 1993. Movie about the Battle of Gettysburg. And this is basically what got me into Gettysburg and learning about the Civil War and everything else. Having seen this movie, I was dumbfounded at how well it was done. And similar to the Battle of Waterloo, it's very grandiose. There were a lot of extras, and a lot of the scenes for this movie, they were given permission by the National Park Service to film on the battlefield. And again, there's no CGI. When you see thousands of troops, they're all played by Civil War reenactors. And it stars Martin Sheen, who plays Robert E. Lee, and here's the cast. I'll read it to you. Tom Berenger, Martin Sheen, Jeff Daniels plays Joshua Chamberlain, Maxwell Caulfield, Kevin Conway, C. Thomas Howell, Richard Jordan, James Lancaster, Stephen Lang, and Sam Elliott does a great job playing General John Buford, cavalry commander. And it basically explains the three-day battle at Gettysburg. It gives you a little bit of a synopsis of why they're in Gettysburg, how they got to fight at Gettysburg, and it examines several main characters. It's based on a book called The Killer Angels by Michael Schara. And although that's a novel, this particular movie does justice to the actual characters in the movie. So there's a lot of quotes that were attributed to these generals from the battle that are used in the movie, and they're verified quotes. Tom Berenger plays James Longstreet. As I said, Robert E. Lee plays General Robert E. Lee. Excuse me, Robert E. Lee is played by Martin Sheen. I'll be all right. And Stephen Lang plays George Pickett. Sam Elliott, as I said, plays General John Buford. And it's just a phenomenal movie. I don't know if you've ever seen it, Bob.
Again, I've seen part of it. It's a very long movie.
Yeah, and it's another thing you have to do. 257 minutes if you watch the director's cut.
Yeah. Now it's interesting because You know, I mean, I think one of the longest movies, there's a movie called Showa, and there's also the Russian version of War and Peace that weighs in at 8 hours. Mm. And, you know, there's always a difficult thing. You know, the film was considered successful, even though it box office, it didn't work too well. And of course, any movie that long is going to suffer at the box office because you can only show it basically twice.
Right.
You know,
right.
And also you've got to have people who are willing, you know, to have the experience, if you will.
Yeah.
And it's always been an interesting thing. At what point does an audience kind of like, you know, you start to lose an audience because of the how long it is.
Yeah. Well, all the reenactors they use, I think, worked at scale.
Oh, yeah.
I think Ted Turner at the time funded most of the movie. Mm-hmm. And he actually has a cameo in the movie. So he plays a Confederate officer who dies during Pickett's Charge. So, but it's well worth the view if you're interested in American history, Civil War history.
I have the DVD.
Yeah, slap it on there right after this podcast, Bob.
Okay. So, you just mentioned this Maltese Falcon is the 1941 version. And I always say that actually the great trivia question is, you know, what remake of a film was, you know, far superior to the original? And the answer would be the Maltese Falcon, because actually it was the third time that the story was made. And again, this is a situation where John Huston was working as a screenwriter, and he wanted to direct films. And again, he made the offer to the Warner Brothers, you know, that he would direct the film basically for a dollar and just take, you know, his money as the screenwriter. And I think as a director, he almost always adapted stories. And this is an almost page-by-page transcription of Dashiell Hammett's novel. It was really extremely tight, well done. I call this a kind of thing, it's a small movie. Yeah, it's not very expansive, doesn't have a lot of different sets, doesn't take place in a lot of different places. And again, when that happens, you concentrate on the actors. And here we have Sidney Greenstreet, Peter Lorre, Mary Astor, you know, and of course, one of the sort of great little actors who appear in a lot of films. And you know who I'm talking about. He's not even in the list, unfortunately.
I don't know.
You know, the guy who played Wilmer. And, you know, unfortunately, like his name at the moment is escaping
me. Okay, that's all right.
But you know, he always played these very sort of intense characters. And he appears even in Stanley Kubrick's The Killing. But each scene in this film is just about perfectly acted. You know, there is this ongoing tension. There is the MacGuffin of the, you know, what is the Maltese Falcon? Is it going to be the real thing? You know, it's wonderful, a fine band of thieves they turn out to be. But there's so many great scenes in this. And, of course, this was made under the production code, which meant that other aspects of the novel could not be presented. Like, for example, in the novel, Bridget O'Shaughnessy, who is the femme fatale, seduces Sam Spade. Mm. Played by Humphrey Bogart. And of course, that's only implied in the movie.
Is it the Hays Code you're talking about?
Yeah. Although I asked my students about it in class, and I said, so what's the relationship between Bridget O'Shaughnessy and Sam Spade? And one of my students said, he's boning her, right? And I said, right. Yes, but you can't show that. You know, so... So there's, it's just sort of implied. And one a little bit of trivia that I came across recently is that when the Maltese Falcon finally makes its appearance, it's in the hands, it's all wrapped up in newspaper, and it's being held by a man named Captain Jacoby, who's been shot multiple times by Wilmer, played by Elijah Cook. I say I knew the name.
Good job, Bob. Yep.
And so he drops the thing. He says, you know, the Falcon. And that's his only line, and he drops dead. And that's Walter Houston, John Houston's father, making a cameo appearance.
Really? Interesting. In the film.
Yeah.
It was, I remember it was interesting to see Peter Lorre not in a horror picture.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is, you know, he was a great actor in Germany. He stars in one of the great classic films, M, directed by Fritz Lang. And, of course, he escaped the Nazis and came to the United States. And he and Humphrey Bogart were actually great friends. And Peter Lorre was the one who told Bogart that he should marry Bacall.
Yeah, because wasn't he always in, like, Frankenstein-type movies?
Yeah, he got a reputation for being in that movie. I remember he was in one movie where a hand was chasing him.
Yeah.
Disembodied hand.
Yeah. And Sam Spade, didn't that become a series on television or something?
Well, probably that. And of course, you know, Raymond Chandler's detective, you know, they, you know, became like a staple, Mickey Spillane, staple of 50s television. You know, having these series because, you know, there were all these short stories that were published in the pulp magazines. They could make, you know, TV episodes out of.
So this came out in 1941. Was there have you seen the 1931 one?
No, I've just heard about it. Mm-hmm. And
is it an English movie? English language movie?
No, yeah, it's American movie. I forget what it's called now, but I've never seen it. I've never seen it presented.
I thought it was called The Maltese Falcon when I was looking on Wikipedia.
Right. Yeah. But then they called it something else because they didn't want to confuse it with
Maltese
Falcon. Mm-hmm. You know, but yeah, it's the same story.
I don't know what you can see on your screen.
I can see the Wikipedia. Oh, I mean, the 1931 page.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, I think that, you know, you had, I would like to see it just because I'm curious, but,
It's generally regarded as a great remake, the 41 version.
Yes, yes, perhaps the best remake of it. You know, I mean, it's very tight, and but it's interesting because the 31 version was pre-code. It might actually be a little bit more
racy.
Racy.
Yeah. Oh, there's an impetus to watch it.
Yeah.
All right, Professor Pucci. My number two is The Godfather, and. I just found it to be one of those movies you can watch over and over again, you know, just the acting, the cast of characters, the storyline, where it takes a relatively innocent and naive Michael Corleone and watch him transform throughout the movie to be the Godfather, to become the Godfather. So it's just a masterpiece in my view.
Oh, it is. I mean, a lot of, you know, polls put it at number two, you know, on the all-time American film list. And certainly it is kind of like a great film. I think, you know, when it was made, they weren't quite so sure of the kind of success it was going to be. But I think one of the things that made it interesting aside from the casting, which was very good, was the cinematography.
Yeah.
Because it was filmed like an epic film.
Yeah. It's, you know, it, like, The color scheme.
It wasn't filmed like it was going to be a gangster movie.
No, it was filmed like they knew it was going to be a classic, right? Is that what you get now?
Well, they were giving it that, you know, I think they talked about how, you know, the structure of the crime family sort of echoed kind of like ancient Rome, mm-hmm. you know, and they were trying to give it a kind of a sort of a classical edge to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of rich, dark colors in the movie.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was, you know, it was really interesting in The Godfather 2, one of the scenes takes place in the same study that Marlon Brando occupies at the beginning of the film, and it looks nothing like it. Mm. You know, it's just kind of like a plain room.
Yeah.
You know, and I think Francis Ford Coppola did that on purpose. One of the things that he was sort of horrified about from the effect of the film was that people, you know, liked The Godfather and was kind of like emulating the words, you know, leave the gun, take the cannoli. You know, I mean, they were all.
Well, there's a lot of there's a lot of quotable lines in that movie, that people still quote today.
These are bad people. These are bad people who do bad things. You're not supposed to empathize with them. You're not supposed to, you know, want to emulate them.
Yeah.
And so he tried to fix that in Godfather 2. I don't know if he did or not, but certainly, you know, Michael Corleone becoming this very sort of cold-blooded murderer who would even kill his brother. Sort of like he was trying to say, no, you see, you got to get it right. You know, it's sort of like, you know, Don Corleone is not a nice guy. You know, he's not a wonderful man. You know,
I don't know if Francis Ford Coppola had anything to do with this. I don't even know if you've seen it, but have you ever seen the run where it intertwines one and two into a combination?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's well done in that it's chronologically correct and it's sort of kind of seamless the way it's intertwined together. But I don't know if you could pick. I think, you know, a lot of people, if they had to choose between one and two, would choose one.
I mean, they're both extremely well done. And again, in some polls, they appear as two and three.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And The Godfather 3 doesn't come into the discussion in anybody's book.
No, that kind of, I don't know. First of all, I don't know if their heart was in it, but, and it has one scene, which I think they lifted from a James Bond movie. It's just a little over that top.
It went off the rails a little bit. Yeah. With the Vatican and all that stuff. But it's also, like you said, it seemed like they knew they were doing a bridge too far. You know, they were taking this Godfather 3 too far.
Yeah, I don't think that, Francis Ford Coppola was particularly interested in making it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it shows. All right. Pointed if I didn't say my number one is It's a Wonderful Life. It's another Frank Capra movie. Came out just after the end of World War II and stars, again, his favorite actor, James Stewart, and Donna Reed. And it's basically a tale of a hardworking guy who, through no fault of his own, gets waylaid by life and redeemed at the end. In a nutshell, that's what it is. But I've only seen this movie maybe 60, 70 times, so I really have to revisit it, you know. I don't know where it falls in your – yeah.
It's kind of like one of those musts, you know. It's one of the must of the Christmas movies.
Yeah.
Perhaps the one that's kind of like most rewatchable.
Yeah. Well, everybody and their mother has seen it by now. I can say thanks to my older brother, Steven. I used to watch this at like 1:30 in the morning on – Christmas Eve into Christmas morning on Channel 5 before anybody ever even heard of the bloody thing. So it failed at the box office when it came out, and it was sort of like an afterthought for about 30, 40 years. And then for some reason it started to take off in the 1980s. And then I remember it would show once a year. This is before DVDs. This is before home. You know, you could have movies at home.
Right.
We used to have to wait for it to come out, and it would come out on PBS every year for a while, and it was their fundraiser. So, you know, they'd show 25 minutes of the movie and then 45 minutes of fundraising.
Uh-huh.
Very frustrating, you know. But, you know, and then I guess NBC or some big company bought it, the rights to it, and now everybody and their mother owns a copy, you know. Mm-hmm. But it doesn't take away from the greatness of the movie, just the screenplay and the acting. It's Jimmy Stewart at his best. If you want to see what acting is all about, just watch the scene with James Stewart and his father, George Bailey and his father sitting at the dinner table when the two of them are talking to one another. If you don't want to watch the movie, this is another long movie, but if you don't want to invest the time, just zoom ahead to that particular scene. Mm. Teach you what acting should be about.
Right. And I mean, and it was very sort of fraught time for both Capra and Stewart. They were both coming back from World War II. Stewart had a very distinguished military career.
Yes.
In the Army Air Force.
He was a combat pilot.
Was making documentaries. And they were both kind of like, you know, at the same time, the Supreme Court decided that the film studios had a monopoly and that they had to break up their companies. And so people went from being under contract to kind of free agents.
Right.
I noticed this was put out by Liberty Films.
Yeah.
Kind of like, you know, whoever heard of them. You know, so they were both, you know, both trying to regain their footing in the industry. Jimmy Stewart succeeded extremely well. Capra, not so well.
Yeah.
But he was the most successful director of the 1930s, won the Academy Award 3 times.
Yeah. All right, Bob. So now we'll do your number 2 and number 1.
Okay. So my number 2 is a Stanley Kubrick film, one of my favorite directors. And in fact, I could have put 2001 A Space Odyssey on my list. I could have put Barry Lyndon on my list. I could have put Clockwork Orange on my list. But I chose Dr. Strangelove because, you know, it's perhaps his most playful movie.
Mm-hmm.
And it has incredible tour de force performance by Peter Sellers, who plays 3 parts and was supposed to play 4, but broke his leg. And we got Slim Pickens. You know, the other story about this, which I find very interesting, is that George C. Scott, who's a very serious actor, you know, would be doing his scene. And Kubrick would say, you know, I'd like you to do that again, George. But this time, I just want you to do it over the top, just for fun. And, of course, he used all of those takes.
Yeah.
With George C. Scott being over the top. And he is. And it's a wonderful film. And
it's George C. Scott pre-Patton, right?
Yeah, pre-Patton. And for him to kind of like, you know, being like, you know, talking about nuclear war and saying, it's sort of like saying his famous line, I'm not saying we wouldn't get our hair mussed, but we'd only lose like maybe 30 or 40 million people. And, you know, the outrageousness of it. And
the irreverence. The irreverence.
The irreverence of it.
Yeah.
But also it's, you know the character of the general who goes crazy and orders the bomb strike is based on a real character, a real general, Bombaway LeMay.
Yes.
You know, and of course, the Dr. Strangelove character has been linked to Henry Kissinger. It's a very sort of it's satire, and satire is a very difficult genre to get right.
Well, anybody wants to read a little bit about real history can learn how Curtis LeMay wanted to end the Cuban Missile Crisis. It wouldn't have worked out too well in retrospect.
No, but you know, the thing was that you know, the same year this came out. A very good, excellent director, Sidney Lumet, who did 12 Angry Men, did a movie with Henry Fonda as the president facing a nuclear crisis called Failsafe.
Yes, good movie.
Hardly anybody remembers Failsafe. They all remember Dr. Strangelove.
Yes.
And maybe because it was over the top, but also that it kind of like gave you pause because, you know, at the end, all these nuclear bombs are going off. And we're hearing, we'll meet again sometime, some sunny day, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just kind of, in a way, at the end, it's kind of chilling, even though throughout it's kind of like extraordinarily comic. You know, the infamous, you can't fight here, gentlemen. It's the war room.
Yeah. I always wondered if anybody in the Kremlin ever watched that movie during the Cold War. I'm sure they did.
And they probably didn't like it. You know,
yeah. Well, they probably didn't see the humor. It's the humor is rather obvious, you know.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't know if it translated well in the Kremlin there, you know.
Well, they probably wouldn't appreciate the perspective.
Yeah.
So I guess I'll go on to my number.
All right. Without any kind of a drum roll, Bob, we'll get right to your number one.
Number one. Well, you know, recently there's a company called Phantom Events, and they put on screenings of films, you know, in various, you know, sort of your local theater with maybe one or two showings. And recently I had the wonderful opportunity to see Casablanca, my favorite film on the big screen.
Wow.
And you know, it certainly holds up beautifully, you know, on the big screen. I remember seeing it for the first time in Greenwich Village, I think when I was 17. And I don't know how many times I've seen it, but again, you know, you've got the play of the actors, you know, you've got Bogey in one of his great performances. And the scene that gets to me every time, I think, you know, one thing about a film that makes it a great film is that it provokes an emotional response.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the love story is just the love story. A kiss is but a kiss. Sigh is but a sigh. But the scene where they sing the Marseillaise.
Uh-huh. That's a great scene, yeah.
It's just priceless.
Yeah.
And it's all the more heartfelt because almost everyone in that scene was a refugee.
Yeah, and you have to know the context in which it was filmed. This came out in 42. It was probably filmed in 41 when France was occupied by Germany.
Right. And the interesting thing about it is that, you know, a little while ago, a book came out, and it was a book about propaganda films. And, of course, they had all of the Sands of Iwo Jima and stuff like that. But they didn't have Casablanca.
Hmm.
And in my opinion, Casablanca was the greatest propaganda film.
It was, sure.
Because yeah. it basically set out the whole problem and created the quintessential villain in the Nazi.
Uh-huh.
You know, Conrad Veidt is the model for every evil Nazi that appeared in film thereafter.
Right. And the redeemed Frenchman played by what's his name?
Claude Rains.
Oh, Claude Rains, yes, Rains, yes,
who,
yeah.
Yes, who was the evil senator.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing how, you know, in these lists, you know, the same actors keep popping up. I mean, that was part of the idea of the studio system that, you know, somebody was under contract and worked every week in some movie. But I think that, you know, in this case, you had a movie that had this incredible message. You know, and it was sort of wrapped in a love story. And I think that one of the great sort of ploys of film is that if you want to have a serious theme, you can't be strict about it. You know, nuclear holocaust is a very serious theme. And if you do fail safe, a lot of people are going to be turned off by it because you're being too serious. But if you make it Dr. Strangelove, okay, yeah, and then we're going to ponder it afterwards. And in Casablanca, you've got the love story, you know, which is the, if you will, the distraction to what the real story is.
Right.
You know, and that makes people watch it, you know, but they can't help but absorb the rest of it.
Yeah, the moral of the story.
Right. Yeah. Right. And the need for America to be involved.
Yeah, it was very early in our involvement in the war when the movie came out. In fact, yeah. Pearl Harbor was probably still smoking when this movie came out.
Yeah, and I think that you know, kind of like is a way in which, you know, Hollywood was, you know, basically trying to maybe teach the audience something.
Mm-hmm. And he is looking at you, kid, is the great quote from it. And play it again, Sam. But I don't think he ever said play it again, Sam.
No, he said, play it, Sam. You played it for her. You could play it for me.
Yeah.
That was his actual line.
And who to blame for the misquote? Is it Woody Allen?
Yeah, Woody Allen. Woody Allen is to blame. But also, you know, again, you've got a great performances by, you know, Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet. Mm-hmm. And Paul Henreid as the very sort of righteous
French resistor or
resistance fighter. I came up with a Casablanca 2
mm-hmm.
you know idea, and I wrote out a little scenario. It's after the war, and Paul Henreid's character is in the United States with Elsa, and he's become like a boring professor who talks about his triumphant days, and a mysterious man suddenly appears in the area, buys up this house, and he's supposed to be a Frenchman named Renault, but it's actually Rick.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, Have you learned nothing? Have you learned nothing from Godfather 3, Bob?
Well, but I thought, you know, this could really work out, you know, and they get together and,
you know. You take the war away and, you know, it takes the punch out of the storyline, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, just sort of like the follow-up, if you will, you know, if you had to have a sequel.
Yes. Well, we had a lot of bumps and false starts to this podcast, Bob. I appreciate your time, but I wanted to just go over a few left outs that if we, as I said in the beginning of this podcast, had we filmed this tomorrow, these might have been in. Because, again, everything we picked is subjective, and it could change from day to day. So don't read it. Anybody listening or watching us, don't read too much into it. But I was going to mention, we did mention Citizen Kane. You're the professor of media and communications. I wanted to know why that wasn't on the list.
Well, part of it is because it's maybe too obvious, and you know, and I've seen it so many times, and everybody, you know, there was a thing where somebody asked a question: "What is your favorite foreign film?" Don't say The Seven Samurai, and don't say 8 1/2 or something like that.
Yeah, so, I understand.
So it's like, you know, to say Citizen Kane, and everybody, oh, yeah.
There's a pretty good percentage of movie lovers that think that was overrated as well, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I have different feelings about it every time I see it. You know, sometimes I feel sorry for him. Sometimes I don't.
Yeah.
You know, and but I do see all these wonderful layers in it, and that's one thing that makes it you know, kind of like a great film.
Yeah.
But if you said you know, if I had the choice between watching Sullivan's Travels or Citizen Kane, I'd probably take Sullivan's Travels.
And what about The Grapes of Wrath?
The Grapes of Wrath is also a great film. That was also on my sort of alternate list.
Yeah.
Because of the cinematography. And also, you know, you can't deny John Ford a spot. as a great director, and that's probably one of his best films. And of course, he's known for his westerns, and I might have put The Searchers on that list. The Grapes of Wrath, I can see it, you know, in my mind, Greg Tolan basically took all that great photography of the Depression era,
right?
WPA photographs, and he just made it into a film. Beautiful.
Yeah. Well, my two alternates would have been Tora, 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 again for the military aspect and the grandioseness of it. The what I like to call kitchen sink, where they throw everything into a movie. And a sleeper, if you don't mind, called Mac, M-A-C, and it stars John Turturro.
Okay.
If you ever happen to, he's one of my favorite actors, and if you ever happen to come across it, I highly recommend you watch it.
Okay, he's also very versatile. I mean, yeah. You know, he's the Jesus in the Big Lebowski, and
yes.
And he's one of the clowns in Oh Brother Where Art Thou?
Yes. Well, like me, you grew up in New York City, and just based on that alone, I think you'll enjoy Mac if you happen to come across it.
Okay.
And I do appreciate you coming on tonight, Professor. It was great having you. It's going to be a challenge to my editing skills, which are limited to begin with. But we'll see what happens. We'll make this a snappy episode.
Okay.
All right. Have a great night, sir. We'll see you further on at the road. We have a lot more to talk about.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Professor. Good night.